I'm Sky Cooley.
And I'm Andrew Abernathy. And welcome to the Oddfellows Podcast, a podcast where we talk about transdisciplinary research and what it means at OSU and beyond. All right. Well, it's the March edition of The Oddfellow. Sky, how you doing?
Ready for spring break, man. Voice is gone. Went to the NCAA. Well, not the NCAA tournament. Went to the Big 12 tournament for basketball, women's ball.
Kansas City.
Had a good time. We won one. The girls won one game. Unfortunately, couldn't beat Baylor there. I don't know that I could have – my voice would have lasted another game. Back-to-back-to-back might have been too much. So I'm on last little leg here, all I've got.
Yeah. Well, you know, we had Anagret Asi on our podcast a few months ago, but we still have the NCAA tournament in play. So
I know. I'm hoping Elite Eight. That's, you know, they could have beaten Baylor. I really think they could have beaten TCU. It's a great team. You know, just a couple little shots here and there, you know, just the way it goes.
Well, we will see where they stand by the time this podcast comes out later in March.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I think it starts the 19th, right? Is it next Wednesday?
Could be.
I think it's next Wednesday.
Well, yeah, I'm going to be on spring break. So we're taking the family to Branson, Missouri.
Oh, fun.
And that'll be, you know, roller coasters, Titanic Museum, all the good stuff. What about you?
Okay. Well, we're taking, I think, 18 students to Scotland. Scotland! So I've got my kilt. This is our second time to go to Scotland. This is our, I think, sixth study abroad trip that Asia and I have done with the SMSC. This is our fourth one to run the Through the Orange Lens magazine. So we're producing the magazine. We've got all the students ready. They're getting their camera equipment, video equipment, social media stuff going. They're all going to hit the ground writing stories, and we leave Friday with that group, and hopefully all is smooth sailing, smooth flying, and then smooth once we get there, you know.
Well, what I love about you, and I think that's something that our listeners should know, is like when you design you design these discipline specific study abroad experiences, but you can bring in students like y'all have biology, psychology
oh,
students.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And like they may not be media majors, but they're having this great experiential learning opportunity and they're getting to see the world.
Yeah, you know, I think that the experiential learning part is really the key to it. I'm really proud that we do that magazine. You really do learn a lot about media production, you learn a lot about being on the team. And it really is. I mean, we have kids from, you know, everywhere. We've got kids from ag. We've got kids from, like you said, biology. We've got kids from mathematics. We've got kids from graphic design. In fact, I think this is the first trip that we're taking where we have more outside majors than SMSC majors in it. So it's really quite the eclectic little blend that we've got. But everybody's bought in, and I think we're going to have a really, really good time for it.
Okay, well, sounds good. Don't eat too much haggis while you're there. Okay. All right. So we got a big podcast today. We're
going
to talk
show.
To Liz McCullough from the Department of Integrative Biology. She has some exciting research. And then also, well, Sky, how are we finishing it today?
We're doing it with the Butter Club. I mean, how can you not interview the Butter Churning Club? Once we found out that there's a club that actually churns butter on campus, you know, we had to do it. It was odd enough.
Yeah, we might ask them some odd questions. So next up, our interview with Dr. Liz McCullough. Today's guest is Dr. Liz McCullough from the OSU Department of Integrative Biology. Liz is an assistant professor who studies how the brain processes sound location information, exploring factors like genetics, social needs, environmental cues, and more. She's a 2024 recipient of the College of Arts and Sciences Early Career Faculty Award, and Liz is a champion for training the next generation of scientists with a special emphasis on diversity and inclusion in STEM fields. She's also a competitive ultimate frisbee player, and you might just get the chance to meet Liz and her canine companion Jack at an upcoming Pete's Pet Posse meeting. Welcome to the podcast, Liz.
Thanks for having me.
No, thanks for being here. So we've got our little small talk section before we get into this. And I was talking before, have you ever read or do you know of the work, just looking at some of the stuff you've done, by Oliver Sacks, the Musicophilia book? Have you ever read that? Or
nope.
Okay. I was curious because we were talking about like the idea of sound and its location and the argument that we're all in this big floating sort of resonance of sound. I thought to be an interesting argument. Yeah. No. Sorry, I've side-railed us now.
No, that's okay.
Maybe I need to bring that up in my honors acoustics class. That would be really cool.
Yeah, it's a really cool book. I'll have to send you the link to it.
Well, welcome for joining us today. How's Jack doing?
He's good. Yeah, he's the laziest dog ever. I got home last night from a conference and I got all the way to my bedroom to the bathroom before he got up where he was asleep in the closet, like 5 feet away. And he was like, oh, hey. Oh. And then went back to sleep.
He
and
sleeps in a closet.
In the closet. In a nice safe place, you know?
As a Harry Potter style.
He's tornado proof.
Do you have the trading cards for him? Is that right? Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. We tried to get our dog to do it, but Valley just didn't have the chops. She didn't have what it took. She couldn't pass the little, you walk with the, you know, you're in the training, you have your dog, and then someone comes up to you with their dog. Got to greet the other dog. Valley just couldn't take it. Yeah. It's too much pressure.
We thought Jack would struggle with that one too, but it turns out he's just lazy. So it works out. And food motivated.
Yeah, exactly. The treat oriented. Like
I'm the same way.
Yeah, exactly. I think a lot of people can relate.
Well, so Liz, you study how the brain processes sound. So naturally, we thought podcast would be a perfect thing to have you on.
It's true.
So first off, tell us the primary goals of your research on how the brain processes sound location information.
So our lab, we break up into a few different teams, usually around mostly what animals folks work on. So we have team mice, and that actually works on a mouse model of genetics that are similar to mouse and humans that are shared with autism.
Okay.
So we know that there are some genetic forms of autism, and the cool thing about mice is we can manipulate their genes, and they share a lot of the same genes with humans. So we look at a specific gene called Fragile X that is common in both mouse and human, and it leads to autism in people. So we basically make the same mutation in mice and then look at how their sound processing is different. Because we know that people with autism tend to be really sensitive to sounds.
I see.
Right.
So team mouse.
That's team mouse.
We have team prairie vole. Prairie voles are super cute, fierce little fuzzy rodents that pair bond and do biparental care. So they both care for their offspring.
Cool.
So they're a really nice model for social interactions, much like people. And so we're really interested in how something like one of their offspring calling, or like us and our kids calling, might actually figure into their sound location processing. Hmm. Like if my kid screams on the playground, or I'm sure yours does too, right? You know where they are immediately, and you know it's your kid and not another kid who fell off the slide, right?
Yeah.
And so we think our brain is actually tuned to be able to find that signal faster because we know it's ours and it's a social information. So we're using them to try to kind of explore how social information might actually tune our brains to specific frequencies in this case.
Cool.
So team prairie vole. Last one is team wild rodent. So we actually go out around Oklahoma and collect wild rodents.
Oh,
my one student has actually branded himself as a pest control specialist. Like, so he's trying to catch rats and some other things that people don't want around. With the idea that we have a lot of diversity in the way that we can process sound location information. And rodents are awesome for this because they live everywhere, right? We can't get rid of them. So they live in our houses, they live below ground, they live above ground, they're really social, some are antisocial. So we can then compare across all their brains and kind of see how they process sound location different. And then last but not least, we have Team Frog.
Okay.
So I collaborate with a collaborator in my department, Michael Reichert, and we're really interested in how male and female tree frogs might process sound location differently, because males are always calling and competing for that sound kind of scape, and females are listening. And so by the fact that one's more of a receiver and one's more of a signaler, they might actually have differences in their brain in how they process sound.
Yeah.
So that's my lab in a nutshell.
Wow.
All focused on all sound location, but across lots of different kind of questions.
I'm picturing like bringing in new students like Harry Potter, like a sorting hat. So you're on Team Prairie Vole.
Team Frog over here.
You're on Frog.
That's kind of what happens, because most undergrads who rotate in the lab don't really know what they want to do, or they think they have an idea. And so I let them kind of orient for 2 weeks and pop into the lab, see what everyone's doing. And then they're like, yeah, I definitely vibe with Team Wild Rodent. Like, I would love to be out in the field. Others are like, autism, that sounds really interesting, right? It's relational to me personally, right? I know people, I'd love to do that and understand it more. Other people are like, that student is awesome. I really want to work with them. So it gives them kind of an idea of like what science is in the lab first before they have to pick.
Is there one team that's more popular than the other?
I think they're all kind of popular. Well, Team Frog, I think, because it's seasonal, is a little bit more difficult just because we need folks like when the frogs are calling. And so it's a little bit harder to get folks in there full time because there just aren't frogs full time.
Yeah, I'm 100% on Team Wild Rodent. That's where I would
that's
land.
I feel like, we need characteristics like, you know, Team Wild Rodent are like the outdoorsy kind.
Yeah.
We're Patagonia.
So I have read some things that talk about how mothers are more attuned to hearing, when the baby's small, they're more likely to wake up because they're always processing sound. I'm just asking, I know I'm deviating a little bit, but where are some of the applications for what you do? How does it translate over into everyday practice or in our lives with some of the research that you do?
Yeah, so we think that there's this hormone that helps regulate that called oxytocin, and it's known to be the hormone that is involved in pair bonding. So whenever we make new relationships or fall in love or, you know, those kinds of things, this hormone's involved. And it's really important in birth. So it seems like there's a natural segue, like at birth, for example, of a new offspring, that that hormone's really high. That would be a prime time to kind of reorganize the brain a little bit and help us, again, now care about something we never cared about before.
I see.
Before I had kids, babies crying, I go the other way, right? Like, not like go towards it.
Right. So true.
You kind of need that retuning, right? That's not just you've now formed a new relationship, but your brain is actually now more sensitive potentially to new things that it wasn't before.
Cool.
Though there was a really interesting study actually in prairie voles that got rid of oxytocin, and we thought for sure, like, that's
they're
it.
They're just going to walk away. Yeah.
No, they still pair bond. So we actually think it might be things like what I'm talking about with tuning of sound that's more subtle that creates those relationships. Like, they're still there and they're still bonded, but maybe they're not as good at it, right? Maybe they're not as tuned to their offspring. Like, maybe they're not retrieving their pups when they come out of the nest as well, or things like that. Mm-hmm. So it could just be that it's doing much more subtle things that make them good parents, right?
Like what kind of subtle things?
Like picking their pups up out of the nest. So a lot of times the pups are kind of wriggly little masses that are helpless, right?
Right.
And so if they fall out of the nest, it's responsible for both parents, in the prairie vole's case, to go and pick them up and put them back, or they get too cold, or they might get eaten if they're out in the wild. So it's really important that they're tuned to those offspring calls or to their mate, like if their mate's signaling that there's a predator, right, to go hide, things like that. So you need to be more sensitive to those social information than you would otherwise.
Wow. It's a really fascinating
field of study. People too, right? We all have the same circuitry in our brains as well.
I keep thinking about how my wife keeps getting mad at me when I put my earbuds in at home.
You can't hear
anything. You're not parenting anymore.
I'm not parenting anymore. I'm cutting it off.
You've turned it off.
So, Liz, if you could describe your lab in three words, what would they be?
I thought about this one. This is the one note, so I had to think about it again on the way back here. But I think hearing, obviously, because all of this is related to sound, and a lot of what we do has other applications in people too when it comes to hearing. Neuroscience in general, because most of what we do is sound location stuff and hearing, but we also have a project with Dr. Lucas in nutrition looking at Alzheimer's, for example. So, you know, I really think of myself as a neuroscientist first and foremost. And then the last thing, I actually asked my lab, like, what three words would we have right on our Slack? And none of them said anything science related. They were all like, well, not directly. They were all like, diversity, equity, inclusion. Everyone's here. Like, this is a safe place for all people. So I was like, well, the last word really should be scientists, because it's not necessarily about the science we're doing, but also this community we're building where people can come in and have access to doing cool stuff that maybe they never really expected or thought about before. Like, slicing a brain is one of the coolest things, to be able to actually see like the tissue and different structures and understand, you know, holding it and touching it in a way that you don't get in a lecture.
And so, for real,
You know, and my lab is open to everybody, but I think we have built a space where people from all different backgrounds feel really comfortable to kind of come as they are and be themselves in the lab, right? We want you to, you're going to be the best scientist you are if you're able to bring
your
whole self, right?
Yeah, of course.
So I think that's one of the things our lab works the best at. And I don't want to take full credit for that, because I think that's mostly actually my students and my undergrads and kind of the community they've built, which is great.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So how many workers do you have in your lab right now?
I have 7 grad students.
Okay.
6 PhD students and 1 master's student, a technician, and then about 20 undergrads.
Wow.
We have a small army.
That is a small army. That's very impressive.
So we might be taking over. Be careful.
Well, it's a great but it's a great tribute to what you're doing that many students want to work with you and get to experience science like that. It's a really wonderful testament to what you're doing.
I think I also need to say no more, but
don't we all?
That is hard. Yeah, that is hard.
Especially when folks want to have I know if they want to do neuroscience, there aren't that many places on this campus, and so if that's truly their passion, I'm like, okay, well, let's give it a shot. Let's see if we can't find you something to do.
That's fantastic. So, have you all found anything recently that's been particularly exciting?
We just came back from the Association for Research in Otolaryngology, which is a mouthful, but basically a big hearing conference in Orlando, Florida, and I think one of the coolest things, and this isn't necessarily science, but that I got to see was my students like owning their science you know, presenting their posters, being really confident in what they're talking about, explaining it well to other people, getting really good feedback, because the thing I love about this conference is everyone is very approachable and will give you feedback, but do it in a way that you're like, oh, I get excited to come home and do it and not like rejected about your science.
Right, right.
So I think, yeah, just seeing my students grow was probably one of the coolest things our lab has done recently.
Have y'all worked at all, or have you thought about working at all with the sound location? Does that translate over into any new technologies like VR, XR kind of stuff? Do y'all work in any of that area?
So not exactly, but I'm glad you bring that up because we are working with a company called SciGlass, and they basically create VR headsets where you can go and immerse yourself in anatomy. And so we have two setups that we got through a tech-free grant that we've incorporated now into my neuroscience class, and we're doing a little bit with our collection of vertebrates, which is a museum that we have in our department, where you can actually go into the specimens and explore it. And it's really awesome
for the brain
because you can go in and see areas of the brain, right? Like if you can't come into the lab and actually physically slice the brain, how much better is it to then like go in and see it around you, right, and be fully immersed in it? And we can actually quantify stuff in it. So they have tools where you can actually measure things and, you know, trace different structures. Yeah. And we're going to work with them a lot more. I might incorporate it into my grad class this semester, too. We're doing comparative neuroscience. So we're looking at a bunch of different species and how their brains work. And we might create like a mini series where we can actually then use the SciGlass, go in, immerse yourself in that animal, and then talk about, oh, here's how they're smell system works and here's where it is, right? And zoom in and have a little short video.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
It's a really great fun application for it. I mean, that's the perfect application for the technology.
And we're trying to get it actually over here in the gaming suite too, so that like if students want to outside of class, they could come in and actually use it.
In the Cowboy Underground?
Yeah.
Okay, awesome. Yeah okay.
So we've been talking, I need to follow up with them. But yeah, the idea is then, you know, you're not limited to the class time, right? If somebody needs to quantify a bunch of brain samples, they can just come over there in their own time and, you know, sit there and play with it for hours on end.
Yeah, and if the folks haven't seen the Cowboy Underground, there is a fantastic gaming studio down there. It's a multi-million dollar facility. We have the esports certificate with them, so we've done some work with them as well.
And I think they have 5 VR setups there.
And if y'all do need, we have more that you can absolutely use if y'all need. We have a bunch. I think we've got like 40 or 50 of them. And the students don't really check them out as much as I thought that they would, but we've got them if you want to use them.
Yeah, I think the biggest limitation is always the computer, right? Like you need a really good graphics card.
Yes,
get everything working really well. But yeah, it's exciting. I'm excited to incorporate it more and more into our classes.
Yeah, well, let me know if you get that going because I want to know what
I got to dive in too. Yeah, right, yeah.
It's over in my office. You can stop by anytime.
Okay, all right. All right. I might take you up on that. Yeah. Well, to transition a little bit, I wanted to ask you about your 2023 success with the Sound of Science exhibit. What is it? How did you get the idea? And what partnerships did you use to make it happen?
Yeah, I promise I do actual science too. But
yeah,
the Sound of Science exhibit was really a brainchild of just thinking about how can I leverage local resources to work on some really cool stuff to engage the community with what we do. And to me, you know, the sensory scape is really approachable for almost anyone and something that most humans are super fascinated in. It's like, how do we perceive and interact with our environment? And so the Sound of Science is an exhibit that we built and are continuing to build with Kicker. So I emailed Steve Irby one day and was like, hey, can we meet? And he was like, sure. And he's awesome. So we sat and we talked about it and iterated over a few different things. And he was like, I would love to work with this with you. And so I was able to get a small community engagement grant through the college to basically pay for 2 students to work over at Kicker for the summer part time, working with Aaron Surratt, who's awesome, to basically build this exhibit. So Kicker provided all the materials and Aaron's time, and the students got to build all these really awesome, cool exhibits. Like we have one that basically is an array of speakers that sits around somebody who's in the middle, and we press a button, and one of the speakers is playing a tone, and you have to tell us where it is. And it's actually really hard. You would think we'd be really good at it, but we often put it in kind of non-ideal environments, right, that have a lot of reverberation or other things, and especially from behind you and in front of you, folks have a really hard time. They're like, it's there. And you're like, nope, it's over there. So just to show you, like, you know, the different kinds of things that we are studying in the lab, but also as a fun interactive tool for people. We then also built like funny ears that you can put on yourself to like model what it would be like if you were a bear, right? Like what do bears sound like, right? Or listen to, because our ears are one of the things that help us process
channel
sound.
The sound. Yeah. I see.
Yeah.
So you put big fuzzy ears in you, it's going to change processing a little bit.
What a cool idea to go to Kicker. They're a really good resource in the community. It's a wonderful partnership. Really smart to do that.
So we're hoping to go to more schools. And we went to the Native American and Indigenous Folk Science and Engineering Fair last year as the first place that we showed it off. And that went really well. And I'm hoping it'll be the basis for my NSF career grant if that comes through. Which would be nice because we can continue it going then and have some students paid to kind of take the exhibit out on the road.
And what a cool way to get youth involved. Not only are you getting your students involved taking it on the road, but you're also bringing it to young kids and they're getting to explore the science of it too. It's
yeah, and part of the idea was that it should be approachable to anybody. So one of the first ideas I had was like for Kicker to actually take it to like their trade shows and things like that because they have all these really cool
They do a lot.
You know, boom room and other stuff, but then also to talk about the science of the sound because a lot of the folks at Kicker are audiophiles and just love knowing more about the way speakers work and sound, and then we can talk about the other side, like how do you actually perceive that sound information and what does your brain do, and then maybe connect them into what our lab's doing and, you know, have more community engagement between the public and scientists in general, I think is really important.
Yeah, so. That's awesome. I'm thinking of like the emotional qualities of music as well, something to think about measuring. That's really, really cool.
Yeah, we talk about that a lot in my honors acoustics class too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I co-teach with somebody from Kicker.
So
Aaron at Kicker is co-teaching that with me. It'll be offered again in the fall.
That's awesome.
If you're interested in acoustics, it was a really fun class.
Nice. I'm still thinking like Team Wild Prairie Dog. That's where I'm.
Oh, you're still on Prairie Dog?
Yeah. I think I'm saying
you're
it wrong.
You giving up on Wild Rodent?
Wild Rodent, that's it.
Oh, Wild Rodent.
You're back to Team Wild Rodent. I don't know. What team are you on? We haven't heard
for
your
me,
name.
I think I might be
a frog.
No, I was thinking I'm a prairie vole.
Yeah, I think you're a prairie vole. Okay.
Thank you. Yes, okay. I feel seen. I feel very seenly. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
No, you might have to take your AirPods out.
No, maybe.
Be a true prairie vole.
Yo, you said prairie voles are still attentive even when they can't hear, right?
Maybe.
So what's next for you? What are you – any big projects coming down the line?
Well, we have a bunch of grant funding that's pending right now. So if all that comes through, you know, our lab's going to grow a lot. Hopefully we'll get a postdoc. We'll be actually recording from individual cells and how they respond to things like oxytocin or different stimulations that we can do to mimic sounds, which would be cool because then we'll go all the way from a single cell in the brain up to a behaving animal. So we can do everything in between. We measure their whole brain responses. Again, we look at different structures in the brain. Wow. We measure how they respond to sounds in a cool behavioral chamber we have. And we do this across all the questions that I mentioned. So all that stuff, we've got an army of people, like I said, working on a million different questions. So it depends on which question, and they all have awesome things that are moving forward.
Yeah.
How neat. Congratulations building that.
Yeah, just imagine having a community of people who are interested in what you're doing and getting to work with them at all levels, undergraduate, master's.
And it sounds like it's got like a snowball effect, right? Like the more people you have in, the more papers you're producing, the more grants you can apply for. It's really...
Yeah, we submitted 5 papers in December. I wanted to die.
Oh, gosh.
It's like whenever, you know, like there's often stuff all comes together at once. And it was like, oh, man.
Oh.
This was a rough month. Now I'm just waiting for all the revisions to come back at once.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sure reviewer number 2 has thoughts.
Oh,
that's why you, that's,
they did.
That's
they
what
did.
You, yeah. That's why you mobilize the army on that, right?
Yeah. Like you, get to work on this part. You, over there.
It's always reviewer number 2. I don't know why. So I want to ask you about Little Liz. Why science?
So I was always a naturalist. My mom got me this book, and I forget what it's called, but it's like one of the first books about just observing the world and being in nature. Because the first naturalists, really the first scientists, were like rich old white dudes who sat around and just like observed stuff, right? Like they were like, oh, that duck's walking like that. Why does it do that, right? And would just like take notes meticulously for hours, right? And that was me as a kid. Like we went camping and I had a notebook and I was like, I see 4 rabbits, 3 snakes. And I would just write stuff down. Like I already had a lab notebook basically. So I thought I would be a veterinarian, of course.
Okay.
And then realized I didn't want to work with people. I wanted to work with animals. And it turns out veterinarians actually work with people more often than animals, depending on the kind of veterinarian. And so my path just took me more and more towards continuing to observe what animals do and asking why. And when you're talking about observation, ultimately it comes back to why is the brain kind of processing or doing that kind of behavior. So I was like, the brain is so fascinating, right? Like, we still don't know so much of it works, and especially not across animals. So yeah, just kind of.
Was there an experience or a something moment that led you to auditory processing specifically?
I would love to say, like, there was an aha moment where I was like, sound.
Yes.
But I think more often than not, it was life. So my husband's also faculty here at OSU, but he was faculty first at Colorado State. And we were moving to Colorado, and I needed to find a job after I had finished my PhD. And I knew somebody who was there already on the medical campus and reached out to him. And he was an auditory neuroscientist working on the brainstem, which is the area of the brain that I work on. And so I reached out and, you know, was like, Achim, do you have any jobs? And he was like, turns out I do. And so I was like, great. And then got in his lab and I was like, this is actually amazing, right? This is a really cool neural circuit that we know a lot about, but still don't know a lot about. Mm. So kind of found my niche by happenstance.
And it's a great time to do it with the advancements of science now.
Exactly.
I mean, right, there's so many new technologies. I mean, like you say, we're still, we don't know what consciousness is exactly, let alone how sound
But neuroscience
that.
Is growing exponentially, like year to year, just in the amount of technology we can do, the way we can record from the brain in different ways that we never even thought possible 5 or 10 years ago. So it's in a grand time, assuming that we can keep science going.
Yeah, got to keep the momentum going, that's for sure.
So this is a hard-hitting scientific question for you. Why Snoopy?
I had a dog named Snoopy growing up. We found him on the streets, and the vet said he was 10 years old at the time because he had, like, no teeth. He was a brown and white beagle. He was just an awesome dog, and then he lived for, like, 10 more years. So we had him around as an awesome dog for the longest time. And I think everyone in my family kind of has a special connection to Snoopy. I mean, peanuts are great, but really what makes peanuts great is Snoopy.
Yeah, of course. Everybody knows that.
When I wanted to get my, wanted to get a tattoo, I knew I wanted a Snoopy tattoo. And it was actually my sister. I had asked, like, oh, I want to get the Snoopy tattoo, but I don't know what to get. She was like, I saw the perfect comic strip for you. And I was like, where, when? She's like, oh, it was published in the paper. And this is like when I was an undergrad, right? And like, I don't know, 2004.
Okay.
Anyway, I had to go microfiche it.
your tattoo, you had to go microfiche it?
Yeah,
that's old school.
Microfiche is, you couldn't just, and you still actually can't find peanut strips on the internet, like, or at least not last time I checked, but Charles Schulz, like, did not allow them to just, like, be printed en masse, right?
Yeah.
And so I had to find the publication date. When was it printed? And then I had to go to the library at Virginia Tech, where I was an undergrad, find the date of the paper, pull out the actual, you know, and, like, look through the screen and find the date and then print it off, like, a printed photocopy to then take to the tattoo artist.
Yeah. That's awesome.
No, that's nice. I always tell our graduate students how spoiled they are. I'm like, back in our day, we had to go up there. I worked at, for Jinx Broussard, and did a lot of historical studies, and we had to go and look at the microfiche for all these old papers. You had to handwrite that down. They have no idea, these kids today, right?
Yeah, spoiled.
So spoiled. So spoiled.
Though it was kind of cool.
There
was something about being like, I found it. You know, it's like a detective story.
Sure.
Like, it was on this date. And, you know, whatever. Now, can I find that date? And then can I find a paper that printed something on that date that had the strip, right?
Yeah. That's fun. And plus, it's fun to say microfiche.
Yeah.
Sure. All right, Liz, one last hard-hitting question, and then we'll let you go. This one's a bit flawed, but I'm asking it anyway. What do Ultimate Frisbee and neurobiology have in common?
All Ultimate players that I know are super nerds. And so I think when it comes down to Ultimate Frisbee, it's really one of those sports that, like, you can be fast and athletic, and that's great. But if you think and you can process and, like, be the next level in terms of, you know, being smart about playing, you're going to be a better player. So now that I'm old and still playing, it's like, I'm not going to be faster than the people I'm up against, but I can be smarter than them. So to me, the smart players are always the better players. So if you can be young and athletic and smart, you're just, you know, truly going to beat all the competition.
That's a great answer. Yeah. I felt like the fencing club was like that too. you know, always like engineers and stuff, and the old people were still, could still play, you know, you could still compete against the youth.
I will say a lot of the Ultimatos, which is the ultimate Frisbee team here on
the
campus.
Ultimatos?
The Ultimatos, that's their team. Okay,
the Ultimatos, okay, yeah. I love it.
There, a lot of them are engineers, so
yeah,
it fits. There's actually, similar to the Sorting Hat, there's like four archetypes of ultimate player, and engineer is one of them. Scientist is also one, so.
And what are the other two?
Hippie.
Okay.
I feel that. I see that.
And then the jock.
Okay.
Just the, you know, person who's athletic and wants to run around. But, you know, the ultimate kind of started with, like, their barefoot people running around and just throwing the disc. So.
Well, this has been fascinating, Liz. Thank you so much for joining us
today.
Yes,
thank you for coming
on the
show.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
All right, in the studio today, we have two students. We have Darby Gwynn and Kate Barclay, the co-founders of OSU's Butter Churning Club, founded in 2022. This new club has over 231 paid members. Not too shabby.
Not too shabby.
Darby, Kate, welcome to the Oddfellas.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, we're excited to be here.
Yeah, when we heard about your club, we were like, we have to have the Butter Churning Club on the Oddfellas podcast, right? Like, how could you not?
Can't not have
bring in the leadership of the Butter Churning Club.
Yeah. So first question is pretty easy, and either one of you can pick it up if you want to. Tell our listeners, what is the Butter Churning Club?
Oh, okay. Well, the Butter Churning Club is really just we have meetings that we get together and we churn butter, and it's about as easy as that. And it's always bring your own bread, BYOB. Okay. And so we are gluten friendly, and you know, you can bring whatever kind of bread you want or whatever base for your butter. And in our meetings, we'll make different kinds of flavored butter, so we'll add different flavorings in. And yeah, it's just really a time to get to know one another and over butter.
Does everybody have their own apparatus for this, or is it like a communal butter churning?
Yes. So when I say like when we have like the 231 paid members, so what that means is like we have a $30 fee. So basically it's a one-time fee. Once you pay it, you're a lifetime member of the Butter Churning Club.
Cool.
And it gets you a pin, a cord at graduation, your own butter churning jar, so you just bring it back to meetings, and then all the supplies you'll ever need to make any of the butters.
Wow.
All right.
It's really cool.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and ask the next question, Sky. We'll start with Darby. Mm-hmm. Darby, you, why do you, and this is a leading question, so call me out if I'm wrong, but I think I'm safe. Why do you love butter?
So, okay, it's kind of funny, especially if you get to the story why Kate and I, or how Kate and I got to starting the Butter Churning Club, but as simple of an answer as any, Texas Roadhouse, cinnamon, honey cinnamon butter.
Okay.
My mom would make fun of me and tell me that I literally would use, like, butter, like, frosting on rolls. So she ended up getting me a butter churner because I loved butter so much. She's like, you should make your own. I was like, okay. So next thing I know, I mean, I'm here, but, like, I love, like, my mom really is the reason I like butter because she'd make butter, but also, like, I got to, like, Texas Roadhouse really sold it for me because it's different. It's whipped. It's not like the creamy type of butter you get from, like, the store. So I guess it's not really a simple answer, but, I mean, I give it to my mom in Texas Roadhouse.
Nice. My grandma used to eat a butter sandwich. I'm like, that's not a sandwich, Grandma. That's just butter on bread.
That's just two pieces of toast.
It's delicious.
All right, Kate, why do you love butter?
Because Darby loves butter, and it's how we became friends. because with her butter churner that she got for Christmas, we were in the sorority house one day, and we were practically strangers, and she asked, like, oh, do you want to go churn butter? And immediately my ears perked up, like, heck yeah, I do. And so we ended up going over to her apartment and churned butter for, like, 5 hours and just, like, talked forever became, like, best friends almost immediately.
But to be clear, it doesn't take 5 hours to churn the butter.
No. We prolonged the process a little bit because we enjoyed each other's company.
Exactly.
Oh, that's awesome. So what are the latest trends in butter?
Like flavors or just butter?
I know nothing about this topic. So what are the latest flavors in butter? What kind of flavors do y'all put in the butter that y'all churn in the club meeting?
Oh, see, I think we've done cranberry orange, definitely Texas Roadhouse. Mm-hmm. So that's the most popular.
It's the cinnamon?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Honey cinnamon.
Okay. Honey cinnamon.
Yep. And then what we do?
We've done a maple, garlic.
an herb, and then mm-hmm. we did a strawberry butter one time.
Yeah, that was interesting.
A caramel.
Maple garlic sounds dynamite.
Mm-hmm. Well, two separate.
Oh.
Maple.
Okay, I'm already.
And then garlic.
We can make maple garlic.
Sounds great. Yeah.
Maple garlic together. Why not?
I think one that was interesting was a caramel apple butter.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, pumpkin pie butter.
Yeah.
Oh.
You can really do whatever you want. There's, I mean, the most traditional is just salted.
Sure.
But the trends is to put different flavorings into butter and like butter. Like boards. Sage butter would be really good.
Oh, also the butter candles were really popular.
Mm-hmm.
Not that long ago. I mean, we still use it. We use a butter candle.
Yeah, I say we make a butter candle for a little induction ceremony. We have like a little candle made out of butter.
And they take their
that's cool.
piece of bread
and dip it into
it.
The candle.
I didn't know you could make a candle out of butter.
Yes.
So, I mean, I guess it's fat, right? It's just going to burn. Yeah.
Oh, okay. And then you're just dipping.
It just melts the butter, and then you can like dip your bread in it. Yeah.
That's pretty fancy.
Like with Food Safe Wicks. Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
Then your house smells like butter.
It doesn't really.
Nothing wrong with that.
Burst my bubble. So you mentioned it's BYOB, bring your own bread. Mm-hmm. What about the rest of the materials you use? Where do they come from?
It comes from your included like fees. It's a one-time fee, lifetime membership. And so from that $30, we've had different donors and such who have donated some of the cream for our meetings. Sometimes we'll just go buy it from Walmart or Homeland, if you will. But those fees keep us operating, and we found that it's a pretty good balance for how often members show up and like what new members are paying, that we've been able to sustain ourselves pretty well.
Nice.
Any secret recipes?
For the Butter Club or just like for... Like,
for you, do you have like a butter that you've got that you're breaking that out for special occasions? I've got a couple recipes when people ask me, I'm like, nah, I'm sorry, I can't. Like my pie crust, you're not getting that recipe from me.
Honestly, the secret is in the cream that you use. The better, the more like grass-fed and like whole that you get your cream and like where you get it from is what really matters in making a good butter.
Mm-hmm.
So a trusted source for your cream.
That's nice. There's a lot of truth to that. Our donor was very generous with the cream, and it's incomparable.
That makes sense. I've heard like there's certain hams from Spain where they feed the pigs on like acorns and stuff, and they have like a particular taste. So I guess like getting the right grass fed.
Yeah. So the more grass fed it is, like the yellower your butter will be too.
If you
don't have a grass fed cow, then you won't get as yellow butter.
I'm a Kerrygold guy myself. I'm going to Ireland a lot. That's my butter, and you can tell it is very very deep yellow whenever you look at it. Yeah.
I'm a Brahms boy.
Oh, Brahms has got good butter.
Can't go wrong with
Brahms. And can't go wrong with Brahms.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Send the check, Brahms. And Texas Roadhouse. All right. Darby Kate, do you want to play a game?
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay. Today's game is called Odd Knowledge. We are going to test your knowledge of butter today. But you get some choice in the matter.
Okay.
Okay. You can choose between the 3-question test or the 5-question test. The 5-question test is true or false. The 3-question test is fill in the blank.
I feel like we should go with the film. Like,
I think we should too.
I think we should stretch ourselves.
Let's go. Can I ask the first one?
Yes, please.
All right.
Is this a competition?
Well,
bragging rights.
Bragging rights. In ancient Ireland, archaeologists found a 3,000-year-old barrel of butter preserved in a peat bog. How much do you think it weighed in pounds?
Say that 3,000-year-old?
3,000-year-old barrel of butter preserved in a peat bog. How many pounds?
I mean, a pound of butter is so small. And so if it was a barrel, honestly, what is that going to be, like 3,000 pounds? I would not doubt it.
Mm, yeah.
It depends on how big the barrel is.
Yeah.
That's a trick question. How much? My final answer is like 2,700.
Okay, wow.
2,700.
Okay. It was only 77. The archaeologists are going to be really disappointed with that. Yeah. You're looking for the treasure trove, right?
Yeah, maybe so the butter dried out.
It's a smaller barrel.
Yeah. We're thinking
thinking 4 sticks is a pound, and then I guess 4 times 77.
Yeah, 77 still like, seems like a pretty good bit of butter, right?
Thinking
like,
about a good
how
size
many sticks?
Of a keg.
Yeah, we have a pretty big barrel. Yeah.
Next up, in the 1970s, which U.S. state tried to pass a law requiring restaurants to serve butter with bread instead of margarine?
What restaurant?
What state tried to pass a law requiring restaurants to serve butter with bread instead of margarine?
It's got to be somewhere in the South. South Midwest.
See, I still think the South used margarine to make stuff back then.
This is a big dairy state.
Yeah.
Wisconsin. Okay, so Vermont.
Oh. Those are fair.
Darby's correct. It was Wisconsin. Wisconsin.
Good. Good. Sorry, Vermont, Ben and Jerry's, you know.
I love
Vermont.
I
got
Vermont.
There eventually. Yes. Yeah. Wisconsin makes more sense. Big dairy state with the cheese.
Okay. What did ancient Babylonians supposedly use churned butter for that had nothing to do with eating?
Probably like some sort of like medical salve.
Very good. Eye medicine.
Eye medicine.
As a salve for the eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Get an eye injury, rub some butter on that.
Uh-huh. You can give it a try. All right. you got two out of three. Yeah. And as Meatloaf said, that ain't bad.
That ain't bad.
But do you want a bonus question?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Medieval Europe, people could pay their church taxes with what?
I'm assuming butter.
Yes, correct.
Topic switch, olive oil.
It'd be awesome to pay your taxes in butter, right?
Yeah. Like,
I guess take you a lot of work these days, though.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of butter.
That's a lot of butter you have to churn. Yeah, you have to have your own cow. I didn't even think about that.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us today. Darby, Kate, before you leave, can you tell our listeners how they can get involved with the Butter Club?
Yeah, absolutely. So best way is look at Instagram. Our handle is at OKStateButter.
Dot butter.
My bad. But looking at that, they keep it very updated. And then if you're looking to join, especially if faculty is interested, they do host a faculty night. So you can look out for that if that's something. I can't promise that they're going to do it this semester, but it has been done in the past. So, I'd say look at our Instagram. And then if you're really interested, join the GroupMe. But there's a link in the Instagram. So.
Can I add one more part for faculty?
Of course, yeah.
Okay. We are looking for more storage opportunities on campus because, as I mentioned earlier off microphone, most of it's being stored at my house. And I'm graduating this spring. And so if any faculty has any ideas on where to store things on campus or is even interested in advising the Butter Club or being a part of it in a bigger capacity, we'd be interested.
Okay, cool. That's great to know.
Yeah.
Thank you, ladies, for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, awesome.
The Odd Fellows is a production of the Oklahoma State University College of Arts and Sciences. It's edited by B.B. Sultana with production support from Keith Maddox. If you'd like to have your research featured, email us at oddfellows@okstate.edu. And as always, go Pokes.